Everyone has a fave Wendy's Frosty flavor. And when you're choosing from chocolate or vanilla, it's not that hard. But now, there's all new Frosty Swirls and Frosty Fusions. So try picking your fave from Oreo Brownie Fusion, Pop-Tarts Strawberry Fusion, Strawberry Swirl, Brownie Batter Swirl, Caramel Swirl, and Caramel Crunch Fusion. Not so easy now, huh? For a fresh way to Frosty, gotta be Wendy's. Open till midnight or later.
At participating U.S. Wendy's, hours may vary by location. Oreo is a trademark of Mondelez International Group. Pop-Tarts is a trademark of Kellogg North America Co., LLC, used with permission.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
This is Murder in the Morning with Tony Bruschi and Stacey Cole.
That indeed it is. And we have a very interesting episode for you today. Stacey, you have done your digging, and we're going to be talking with Joe Loya, who's actually right there on the screen right now next to me. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hello, everybody.
He's got the podcast, The Burden, Get the Money and Run, telling his life story. Stace, give me a little background here. What are we walking into before we start talking with Joe?
Well, we're going to talk a little bit of childhood trauma and how that shapes a person's life, how it leads them down a certain path, and then basically how you change the course of your life.
Yeah. A story of redemption, a story of something positive for once, which is nice.
Yes, right. Yes, this is a positive story.
Because my God, all day I have been talking Brian Koberger with the FBI, with psychologists, with everybody, and Diddy. And, you know, it's been like 4 hours straight of that all day until I got to this. I'm like, this is going to be a good story. So, Joe, welcome. Thank you so much. Thank you for being a really horrible person at one time and then changing your life.
You're welcome.
I say that tongue in cheek. Obviously, you know, I'm not saying you were a horrible person, but, you know, people make different choices at different times. we all make different choices at different times in our lives, and it all is kind of stems from, you know, where we're at that moment, what made us who we are at that point in time. I want to start and get some background from you. I want to hear about your childhood in East Los Angeles, about your father, about life, and how, you know, kind of what molded you into the young man that you became when a lot of this story began?
Yeah. So, and we cover all this in the podcast, Get the Money and Run, go into great detail. Not only did I talk about the bank robberies among the 30 that I robbed, but I talk about like this. I start off with my childhood and kind of what influenced me. And one of the things that influenced me very early was my parents were both 16 when I was born. They were out of 10th grade. They dropped out of school and they started raising me, but they're very religious. So I was raised in a really cool community of, but like really cool, I mean, I was raised in a community. Mm-hmm. Everybody watched out for everyone's kids. Every Sunday after church, a lot of people were raised like this back in the day, where we'd go have potlucks with family, friends, or family. And we're just raised feeling loved and everyone kind of doing the same thing, believing the same thing. And my mom and dad, they were young, so they were kind of in the young married group at church. They were obviously 7, 8, 9 years younger than the other young married people who had gone to college and then gotten married. So they were almost treated like little mascots. Everyone adored my family, really loved my family. So I was raised really with this love of God, love of of the scriptures. My dad was studying to become a preacher. So my dad, this little goofy Mexican kid in East LA, was ex-gang member. He loved Greek and he loved Hebrew, and he started teaching himself Greek and Hebrew. So he ends up going to college studying languages. So I was raised in kind of a studious home because we were, like I said, loved by the church and the group, the big church we were raised in. We got scholarships to go to private Christian schools. So, like, even though we were these poor little Mexican kids, the community that we were in loved us and took care of us. And when I was seven, though, my mother got very sick. She got a kidney disease. And it was just basically 2.5 years of her dying, slowly dying.
God.
Terrible to watch somebody just, you know, in the prime of their life, just. And the problem was, when she got kidney disease, it was so far along before they caught it that they couldn't give her a new kidney because her body would have rejected it. So what they tried to do to keep her alive as long as possible was use experimental drugs, which did all this crazy, wacky stuff to her. Sometimes she would think she was Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh, wow.
She would call home, want to speak to her boys. She would hallucinate. She would just, you know, she was, you know, it was terrible. And
how
it was
old
very,
were you?
Very terrible.
How old were you at that time?
I was 7.5. Oh, I was seven. Yeah, seven and a half when she got diagnosed.
So when,
again,
when,
she's 16 years older than me, so that would make her like 23.
Yeah.
Right?
So she's a kid herself, you know.
Yeah, and they're playing home, and they're doing the best they can. Yeah. Again, I was loved. Like I knew what love was. And there was like, but as soon as she gets sick, the stress levels go up. My dad, you know, again, he had dropped out of high school. He'd gone back. Finally got his high school diploma, and he was getting ready to go to like junior college and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
He was doing the best he can with the job he had. And of course, bills are piling up, all this kind of stress. He had had a really vicious temper as a little gang kid before he became a Christian, Protestant Christian. We were Baptist, fundamentalist Baptist in East LA, which is a weird thing in a sea of brown Catholics. It was like, we were like very, very few Mexicans. We're like, now all my friends who I was elementary school and high school with in the neighborhood in East LA, they're all evangelicals now, but back then they were all Catholic. So we were like a leading family in that movie. Anyway, bottom line is my mom gets very sick, and when I'm 9, she dies. My dad's stress level is off the charts. He starts becoming a little bit more violent in his punishing us and stuff like that, losing his temper more. Because he had, you know, obviously he had been brutalized as a kid. So, it got pretty bad. He remarried another woman who was a pretty good stepmother. Her name was Brenda from the church. Now my dad was 26. She was 20. I was 10. Wow. Over a year after my mom died, they get married. He wanted a mother for us.
And Joe, before we get to that part, I want to hear more about you at that moment. I mean, at 7 when this happens, and at 9 she dies, and your dad is struggling and trying to, you know, make sense of this. He's dealing with life with the way he knows how to deal with it. Not healthy, but it's the way he knows how to deal with it. What's going through your mind at, you know, how are you processing the death of your mother? Like, you personally, you know, while all this chaos is going on around you, do you have a lot of memories of what you were feeling at that moment?
Absolutely. I wrote it not only in this, I wrote it in my memoir, The Man Who Grew His Prison Cell.
Yeah.
I go into great depth here because this is actually where I started getting very troubled.
Okay.
Super troubled by things.
Tell me about
one,
that.
One, I was dying, and I remember this one incident very clearly. I was very sickly as a kid. I don't know if it's because I knew she was dying. Who knows? But I was staying home a lot because I just couldn't, like, whatever. I had asthma, and I could use as an excuse. So I'm staying home this one time. My mother's, like I said, she's dying. At this point, they have a nurse that's at the house who's giving her food and stuff like that. And she happens to come to the table. The nurse is making us some steak. She needed a lot of the iron and proteins and stuff like that. So salt is the bane of her existence. Okay. Like, that's the first time I saw these little containers of salt that were like a different color. They were supposed to be salt substitutes, right? She can't eat salt. It's terrible for the kidneys.
Yeah, yeah.
So she's seated at the table. Remember, I'm being raised as a righteous kid. Lying's terrible. You want to be honorable. You want to be honest and stuff.
Sure.
My mom, everyone is making sure she's not having any salt. My mom knows she's dying, though. And she's like, you know, screw this.
Yeah.
We're at the table. The nurse puts the plate down. She turns her back. And my mom reaches into her purse and pulls up these little salt packets that she have gotten from the hospital or something. And then the nurse leaves, and my mother puts the salt all over because she loves salt. She used to put salt on apples, oranges.
Oh, wow.
Melon. We would have it on sandia, all our stuff. Mexicans love that salt, man. We love it.
Yeah, yeah.
So she was raised with all this salt, and then she's doing it, and she looks at me, and she sees me looking at her like, oh, my dad's going to go crazy when he finds out about this. And she just puts her finger on her lips and is like, shh. And immediately I'm like confused. I'm like, wait, whoa, I thought we were supposed to be honest. And that, like, what's going on? It's like,
yeah,
it's my first thing where I'm like realizing like, things are a little bit wobbly here. Like, I now know I'm not telling my dad shit about this, right? I'm not going to say anything about it because I don't want to get her in trouble.
Yeah.
But it's also making me think, like, and years later when I don't care about my health, I'm realizing some of this morbidity comes from my mother saying, like, I'm going to eat what I need to eat on the way out. I already, like, it's almost my mother was aware that she wasn't going to be around. And in fact, she wouldn't be around long. She would be maybe 4 more months.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of confusion going on, moral kind of blurriness. But the other thing that happened right when my mother died, I could be caught crying. And the Christians in my community would say, do not cry. Your mother's in heaven, absent from the body, present with the Lord. So immediately my legitimate grief was turned into this shameful thing because I didn't know how to honor my mother's presence in God. So now I feel guilty. And I can't ask anyone to help me grieve. And it is exactly that thing that shoved my feelings down instead of helping me process, like we know today. You got to let you.
It's a Catholic guilt.
Are your body's intelligence. Yeah. They're saying we're housing stuff. Here's how we respond to it. Your body has its own intelligence. And one of them is tears. And we know this now, but they're telling me don't cry, hold it in. Well, holding it in ended up making a lot of people suffer later because I held it in, it submerged, and it showed up in all these other places. My rage here, my rage there, and I directed at other people because when I was young, when I was troubled, when I was legitimately grieving, they were trying to make me feel guilty for it. And I resented that, resented it bitterly. Then my dad starts beating us pretty badly. Now at this point, he has a church. He's a pastor of a church. And we're getting beat up pretty badly, badly enough so that like when I got kicked out of school for pulling fire alarms, which is a tell, like, oh, your kid's acting out, me see that he's in some distress. I'm a sinner, I'm evil, I'm all whatever, Satan's spawn, whatever. I'm treated as not like, hey, your kid's in distress. He's grieving. Nobody will talk to about
like,
it.
Let's help
they
him.
Just
yeah,
it's, label me.
Yeah.
They just label me a sinner. I'm bad. I need to be punished. And my dad beats me so badly that my stepmother won't let me go to school because I have bruises on my thighs and my back. You know, I'm beat up. So beat up, in fact, that she worked for a place called McLaren Hall in Southern California, where when kids got taken from homes for being abused, they got taken there so they could be put in foster care. She's doing these reports all day long. She tells my dad, what you're doing to them, I've seen these in police reports. People get taken out of the house for this. My dad is just being treated. He's treating us like everybody kind of was treating everyone then. People knew that we were getting beat up, but nobody could do anything. But this is early 70s.
It was like people commonplace.
But he was a pastor, though, right? Yeah. You said he was a pastor.
Yeah.
I mean, didn't people at the church know that this was happening? Could they see it?
This was my point. No. The church does not know. And this is also one of the reasons where I start saying, like, you guys are sitting here listening to this man tell you about plans in the future, what happens when you die.
Yeah.
You believe about celestial mechanics, what happens in God's mind and in the future, and you can't see that the two boys next to you are being brutalized. Like, we're evident right here. We're panicky, jittery. We're like, we're giving off things, but nobody pays attention to those signs.
Do you think?
They're all. But to me, it was like, So let me finish this one sentence. To me as a man, and this is going to influence me the rest of my life as I go forward from this moment, I'm seeing these Christian people in these pews as so heavenly minded, they're no earthly good to me. They don't help me at all.
Do you think they were truly not aware of what was going on, or do you think that there just wasn't a mechanism at that moment in time to speak about it? Because so many of those things were so hush-hush, and so many of those parishioners, I'm sure at the time, grew up with that being normal, or they did it themselves to their children. So...
Oh, it's okay. You can't parse out what percentage of it is.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Certainly the people my family knew, my dad's friends knew.
Yeah.
They would try to interrupt it by scolding him or whatever.
Did they?
But that didn't stop it.
Yeah.
That didn't stop it. Eventually, when my stepmother left my dad, she did tell church people at the church, my dad has stopped being a preacher.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the most beautiful moments of my childhood is when my dad quit the ministry. And he told us, I'm gonna quit being a pastor. He was only a pastor technically for 11 months. So it wasn't like he was a pastor all his life. But in those 11 months, he did so much bad to me and my brother that he at the end of 11 months, he says, I'm leaving the ministry. because I'm supposed to be better in the home than I am. So I'm not good. I have to fix my life with God and you guys, so I'm not going to be a pastor. So good on him. But
yeah,
the other reality is that when he still continued to beat us, even though he wasn't a pastor, so much so that when my stepmother leaves, she tells the elders of our new church about it. And the elders confront my dad, but nothing could really be done.
Yeah.
She leaves him. She divorces him. And a year and a half later, during a vicious beating when I was 16 years old, and I think my dad's eventually going to try and kill me and my brother.
Yeah.
I stab him in the neck during a vicious beating, and I try to kill him, try to break the blade off in his neck. Mm-hmm. He survives. We go into foster care. We're taken from him. Now everybody knows how bad it was. I have broken bones. The police report says what it says. I mean, the county takes us away from him. And frankly, he was contrite. He was like, at this point, it's like we saved him too. It's like we rescued him from himself. He couldn't hold himself accountable. The church couldn't hold him accountable. It finally is a court of law that says, we're taking your kids from you. You don't know how to handle your kids. You're beating them up and they're torturing them. Or they're too messed up in their head. So I go into foster care. I have two great foster fathers. But then I'm a Christian still in spirit, you know, at that time. And even now, I'm not a Christian per se, but I consider myself a more credible Christian than I ever was when I was a Christian.
Sure,
I actually believe in a lot of the beautiful things of the gospel. And I'm a big fan of Jesus growing up. I love a lot of the Jesus love story stuff. So all that to say, I feel like my dad has jumped through all the hoops. He shows up to all the foster homes. He's visiting us. He does what I feel like you're supposed to do. He actually was a good example to me as I grew older. I know that when you say you're sorry, you better back it up with your life. If you don't, and in this situation, my dad didn't fake it. He showed up and he was humble. And he was humbled and he was broken. And when we came back, that was my junior year, right? February of my junior year. I come back at the beginning of my senior year, so September. And when I come back, we're praying every night. We're trying to do a thing. The problem is this rage has been ignited in me. Stabbing my dad, oh, I felt so good. The power of that.
It was vengeance.
The first of many men I would stab. And so that was like, oh, I like this because I'm not a victim anymore. I'm not weak. Mm-hmm. And I had been a really nerdy, bookish kid. I wanted to be a theologian myself, studied Greek at age 9. My stepmother turned me on to all the classics and literature. So I was in love with language. I was in love with ideas. But when I stabbed my dad, I started thinking, man, you know what? That's cool, kind of. I liked what I got, validation of church and that kind of thing. But I felt like that was kind of effete. I took this dude off the pedestal. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, I'm coming for God next, man. I'm not gonna just settle with taking my dad as an authority. And I just went against all authority. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing I could do because I felt so strong. So I'm in junior college and I'm working, like thinking I'm gonna get out and I'm gonna become maybe a lawyer or something like that. But I'm still thinking by the time I get out of college, go to grad school, whatever. I'm going to make, what, $40,000, $50,000 a year? I'm the guy who stabbed my dad. I got power in me, and I feel it like this almost like, come on, let's do it again. We need to, like, show ourselves bigger.
Let me ask you about that just for a second. The feeling of, you know, that power that you're feeling built up. I mean, on the surface, you go, I stabbed my dad. It feels great. Like, obviously, today you could look at them and go, that's probably not a good reaction to be having, but the fact that you were having that, I mean, it says something about what was going on in your life. Because you had so little control and you had this father that was overbearing, that had a lack of control himself, that as a child, then it took away any control that you had. It was kind of stealing that back. It was kind of giving you a sense of control, maybe for the first time in your life. And that feeling is that not so much the idea of stabbing your dad, but more so, you associated that with having control for one of the first times in your life. Is that kind of the way it felt?
You're in the right territory here, but I'll be more clear about what happened. I'll unpack that a little bit more.
Sure.
What happened before I stabbed my dad, not long before, a few months before I stabbed my dad, he was very angry. My stepmother had left, and he came in one day, he was walking around like he was a drunk, but he wasn't drunk. He didn't drink. He was brooding at the time. He was so full of rage and so humiliated by the way my stepmother had left him, and he couldn't work. He was going bankrupt because she had left him for a guy at the office. He didn't want to go back in. It was humiliating for him. His life was very stressful. I mean, I understand it now, obviously, as a grown man, but we were terrified at the sink washing dishes. He comes in and he punches my brother in the rib cage, grabs him by the back of his head, starts dunking him in the water, his head in the water. I'm sitting there with a plate, like just frozen. And my brother's like would look up. He's got water coming out of his nose and everything. And he's looking at me almost like beseeching me for help. And I'm just paralyzed with fear. And my dad leans in his ear and says, "You should have died instead of your mother."
Oh, and that
moment, how old was that your brother?
That moment was powerful to me. Let me explain why. I was accustomed to two major griefs in my life, the death of my mother and the brutality and the beatings. And those two were two separate traumas.
Yeah.
What he did when he brought my mother's death into it and our beatings, to me, he married them. And to me, he wanted one of us dead, if not both of us dead, by that remark. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I'm like, what am I going to do? And I wanted to kill myself first because I was like, I cannot be a coward. I'm not wired to be a coward. Mm-hmm. I knew in my heart that I have some bigness. I knew then what I know now, which I've proven, is my narrative was much bigger than that tiny little abused boy who was just going to be abused all his life. That wasn't me. I didn't feel it. And I knew that if I stayed just a coward, I have to die because I could not exist as a coward. And so for several months, I was like, what do I do? What do I do? He wants to kill us. Well, I got to kill him. I have to kill him first. Because now he said this thing about my brother's dying and he's all brooding around the house. He's just indiscriminately attacking us. So when he beats me that one day or a week before, I told his girlfriend, you need to leave my dad. He beats us. And she took us out to this nice steak dinner. And I lift up a steak knife a week before and I say, if he stabs us, I realize all of a sudden I've described myself as this weakling, as this punk, as this lame, and I can't stand the impression I just made of myself. So I pick up the steak knife and say, next time he beats me, I'm going to stab him in the neck. And she says, no, Joey, put the knife down. Put the knife down. Violence doesn't solve anything. But I have now put it in my mind. When my dad does me next time, I'm going to try and kill him. And I thought the neck would be a kill shot. So a week later, when he does beat me, I didn't lose control. He beat me. He leaves the house. And even though I got a concussion, I quietly go to the kitchen, I grab a steak knife, I walk into the bedroom, I put it under the pillow, I lock my brother in the bathroom, and I say, don't stay here until I'm done. When my dad comes in, he begins and he starts disassembling a weight set to beat me with it. I stand up with the knife calmly. He comes, charges me, says, put it down, put it down. I charge him and I stab him in the neck, try to break it off. It was all because I intended to not go extinct, to preserve me. And so what I did violently was I took control of my narrative and I innovated with the narrative and I wasn't a weakling anymore. I wasn't a weak victim. I was now that phrase. I embodied the phrase, ain't no fun when the rabbit's got the gun. I now predator and he was the prey.
Yeah.
And I flipped the script and that innovation will do two things to you. One, it feels really mighty in your body to change your script.
Yeah.
It's what people, everyone knows whoever converts their life from being, you know, prostitutes, drug addicts, killers, and they find God. I see that all the time when people come out of prison and they find God. They change their narratives and it's empowering. Why wouldn't it be?
Sure.
Everyone changes their narrative, gets that power. The second thing was, it was a power in my body. I now own power in my body that was new and novel to me, but accessible to me that other people didn't have. And it was proven by when I went to McLaren Hall. All those beat up kids in there, not one of them attacked a parent. I go to prison, all those mafiosos, all those killers, all those guys who became badasses, when they looked at me and they saw that I may not have been a gang, I may not have been all those other things, but when I was 16, when I was abused, the difference between me and them was I tried to kill my dad. I didn't beat up my girlfriend. I didn't grow up and beat my kids, the dog, attack other people. I went after my dad. That gave my narrative and my body, it's like, oof. So when I tell you a couple years later, I'm like, oh, what's going on? It's because my body was saying, dude, why are you taking the bus? You have a Maserati in the garage. You need to go faster. You got more power than everybody else walking around you. Use this power. And because my dementia, now here's where the bad childhood happens. Because I'm so dark and full of rage that I have no sense of, nobody's helped me process any emotions at all. The one time when they could have helped me, they were shitty at it, right? They were like, don't deal with your grieving emotions. So it turns into rage. That's all it does. Rage is just grief and wound disguise.
Yeah.
So I'm now an adult. I'm looking at working, going to college for 6 years so I can get out and make $40,000-$50,000 a year. I'm like, no, I'm the guy who tried to kill his dad. I'm supposed to do a lot. I'm supposed to make a lot more than this. And so I tried to connive my way into crime, and I started doing petty crimes because I'm like, screw this. I deserve more than this. And I fuck around and do these crimes that are petty crime, just with Grand Theft Auto. I stole someone's keys out of their hand, robbed, I took their car, pushed them down. I did a lot of bounced checks. I just petty crimes, mm-hmm. fraud. For the people who had larceny in their heart, I would make them believe that I was doing crimes in Mexico and I could make them money. So they would give me money. I would just defraud them. But, I was just hustling, trying to figure out how to be a criminal. And it wasn't until I become a fugitive in Mexico after like doing crimes all through Southern California. I go to Mexico with $35,000, $40,000, and I go into Mexico. I'm now 24, 25, and I'm a lame criminal. Like, I'm a petty criminal. I'm not a guy who knows anything about anything. I haven't done really no jail time. I'm not a guy, not in a gang, nothing. Again, I was a nerdy guy. Now, did I have violence in me still accessible? Yes, but I haven't marshaled it yet. Not really. So I go to Mexico, and real criminals see me coming, and they know this guy's here, and he's spending all this money. He probably has a lot of money hidden in his condominium. They go to my condo. I come home one day. Everything's torn apart. All my money's gone except for the $2,500 in my pocket. So I'm like, oh, man, I got to go make money. Mm-hmm. What do I do? I can't defraud people because you got to get close to people to defraud them. I don't have time. And I had not, like I said, I've never robbed liquor store or anything like that, but I'm in Mexico. I get the Corona beer, I lean back, listen to some music, and I think, well, you know what? Pancho Villa, when he was a revolutionary in Mexico, he used to go over the border and he would harass post office and banks, rob them, and then go back into Mexico. And of course, the bandido image is big in my mind too. And I'm thinking, you know what? I should just go in the United States and start robbing banks. And it was like that. The bank robber in me was born. It was just that.
Let me ask
and so
you.
I go.
And, yeah, and I want to go into that, but I want to ask you, what's going through your mind emotionally as you're doing this stuff? Because I mean, you said you were brought up. I mean, prior to your mother dying, you were brought up in a sounds like a decent a house. At least you saw love. You had parents who did care about you. Obviously, things got pretty bad with your dad, without a doubt. You were brought up in the church, and you had some good years there. When you're out there doing your crimes and grand theft, whatever it may be, Grand Theft Auto to whatever, you're affecting people, obviously. That's one moment in your life, because you're doing so much of that, could be a huge moment, or like one of the most pivotal in someone else's life. If they're being assaulted or robbed or what have you, what's going through your mind? Are you feeling any empathy for these folks, or are you like repressing that down? Like what's going on for you emotionally in those moments?
Yeah, no. I think that's, it's a good question. Everyone asks that, but the reality is I'm not inhuman.
No, I know that. And that's why I'm trying to understand.
No, you're not accusing me. I'm saying that to say that.
Yeah.
Because what is happening is, and what happens in humans at that time is you, and this is where I came to understand, because when I changed my life, all of a sudden it's like a switch went on and my conscience woke back up.
Uh-huh.
My conscience, for some reason, I was able to just block it with all the rage and all the things that I would. And the way I moved in the world now was like, okay, you said I was a bad kid growing up. You said me acting out and all this was evil. Guess what? I wanted to be really high in God's army. Mm-hmm. Well, then I'm now going to the other side and I'm going to work my way so I can go really high and be in this army over here. Badness.
Okay.
And so I don't really care about the good. I bifurcated the world just the way I had before when I believed in God. Now I'm like,
sure,
I don't believe in God. So now I'm going to violate everything I ever believed, because all that ended up being hurting me.
Yeah.
Everything I believed, everything I was suckered to believe hurt me.
Yeah.
All the people who said they loved me, they allowed these things to happen. Okay. And so being very simple-minded, my brain's not even fully grown at 23 and 24 when I'm doing all this stuff. What we understand about psychology is so much now, we know that traumatized brains, all the concussions I had from the beatings I had as a kid, that's affecting my choices. The fact that I tried to kill my dad when I was 16, when my brain was in this really traumatic point of development where you don't know about consequences. Like I'm having a lot of things going on with me. So the conscience kind of just turned off, and I gave it like turbo power by now believing and consciously saying, I refuse to believe in the timid moralities that everyone held on to that did me badly. Mm-hmm. I don't want to believe in all that stuff. That stuff is nonsense. I'm seeing straight through the world. And so that's another conversation. But at the time, I felt that the world was lying to me and they were lying to themselves. Sure. I was seeing the world really is. And so I was going to succeed in the world the way it really is. And so I went into crime not caring about people because I was like, you didn't care about me. I'm not going to care about you.
Okay.
There's no contract anymore with you. You guys have been my society for a while. You socialized me and you failed.
Okay.
You did not protect me. That's how I look at society. So
sure, that I'm makes going sense. Through the world. Yeah.
And also part of it is because of the way I was raised, it was easy for me in a traumatized brain to turn everybody into abstractions. Mm-hmm. So like when I go to the bank to rob somebody, I would look at somebody and then to me, they were just a chess piece on the board. I just needed to move from here to there. And the fastest I could do it, the more effective I was, the faster I get my money. Everything was just, people were just like there's figurines to me. And that's what part of like, not because I was conscienceless, it was because I didn't have access to my conscience at that point. When my conscience woke up, all this stuff came on me, almost crushed me.
Sure.
The guilt I had for the victims and all the faces I would be by nightmares I would have of the victims' faces. That stuff, and in the video and in this podcast, Get the Money and Run, they actually interview two of the tellers that I had robbed, and they explained their trauma. And it broke me down again when listening to it. I mean, that's the thing. I have very little guilt for robbing banks. Mm-hmm. They were insured. They were taken care of. I did my time. I have all the pain that I have and anguish I have is for the victims that I created, the women and the men who were the tellers. Sure. They were just doing their job. And I put all this trauma on them that bleeds into their families. And, you know, it had impact. Go on, sir.
Yeah, go ahead.
What do you say to somebody that you traumatized? Can you walk us through how that went? I mean, that's a very stunning moment to acknowledge that you traumatized somebody. How do you reconcile that? And what do you say to them? And did they forgive you?
Well, I didn't talk to them.
Okay.
Because they got interviewed by my cohorts, and they played it for me.
Ah.
And so I had a response. My response to it was pretty dramatic. But people have asked me this question that they said, if you could talk to these people, if you could go up to them, if you could find them, would you find them and apologize to them? And I said, that to me sounds horrific, because one time they were minding their own business, and I had this emotional constipation going on with me, raging in the world and doing all this stuff. And I landed in front of them and said, here, process this. I'm going to process it with you. I'm going to ambush you with my emotion. Now deal with it. And calling them on the phone, sending them an email saying, hey, I have all this guilt and I have all this shame about the way I treated you. Let me just ambush you and throw all my emotion. I need you to help me process it. It feels exactly like the same selfish, emotional move that I made when I was back there. I would prefer for them to come to me, meet me somewhere, send me some. I will sit and listen to them berate me and tell me anything. It's their turn.
Sure.
But I'm not walking up to anybody and saying, hey, I need you now. Help me deal with my emotions again because I can't deal with them.
I hear what you're saying.
It's a really healthy way to look at it.
Yeah.
That's the only way to look at it, because I already victimized them.
Yeah.
Why would I do this again? In the name of what? Oh, I want to look at how sincere I am. Look at how I changed my life. I don't have to prove anything to them. If they want to come to me and they want to berate me and humiliate me, or I'll take it. My turn.
And probably not even berating. I would think it maybe more so just to find some peace in it and maybe see, okay, you know.
One of those victims sounded like he wanted to berate me. Like,
well, maybe there is that too. Who knows? But I'm saying
they're allowed any feelings they want to have with me.
But you're allowing him to do it on your terms. It's like the door is open. If you were someone that I victimized,
I'm happy to talk. I don't want to intrude on your life that you have probably picked up and moved on a lot from now, and come back and go, hey, remember this shit show,
exactly. Like, help me process this so I don't have to feel guilty anymore.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Feel better. No. Don't you feel better?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, because you're not making it about you. You're it's like, if you want to talk, I've admitted my wrong.
If you want to process it with me and do it your way, that's fine.
I'm happy to help you. Yeah. Okay. I hear that.
That's incredible.
You robbed over 30 banks in 14 months. That's quite a run. What was it? I mean, what was your typical day back then? I mean, how are you planning these sort of things? Is it just I don't know how to rob a bank, Joe. how do you? And I'm not asking for like the step by step.
There's a lot of ways.
Yeah, I don't know the step by step instructions.
And there's ways too. There's ways in which I got exploding dye packs and ran away with it. It was crazy. It was a crazy time. Now, here's also the way I understand it: is that I later, as an adult at post prison, I started having issues with, I was under a lot of stress, and I started having feelings of feeling loosey goosey and willy nilly about thinking unstable, and the instability felt like when I was robbing banks, and I was really scared. I was like, oh man, I thought I changed my life. Why am I having these feelings from 1988 again in my body? What is going on? It's 2002. I've been out of prison successful for 6 years. What's happening? Turns out I'm bipolar. And what I was having, it was a bipolar episode that eventually ended up in a hospital. Mm-hmm. And the feeling when I got told I was diagnosed with bipolar, I was so grateful, because for like 8 months while I was going through this episode, I was concerned I had a character flaw, because I was like, oh no, I'm still the guy I was back in 88 because I'm so like feeling so unstable. And now I understand the bank robberies through the lens of mental illness. When you're in a bipolar episode, one, you get manic. Two, you feel this grandiosity takes over. And 30 banks in 14 months is as grandiose as it gets. Like that was off the charts grandiosity.
Like some Grand Theft Auto game shit there.
I robbed four banks in one day. That's as grandiose as it gets. Like I was doing all these crazy things where, I mean, you got to get the money around. I can't even go through them all. Like, some of the escapes are so cinematic, where once I end up in the back of CHP cars, and they drive me from one place to another, not knowing that I just robbed four banks in their city. Like, there's just all these kinds of – there's ones where I'm exploding dye pack, and I have to get chased, and I get away. All these great stories about what happens. But this feeds into the sort of cinematic kind of pace that I was running at the time, where I felt like – again, I had turned myself into a new narrative. I wasn't a petty criminal anymore. Mm-hmm. I innovated with my story in a different direction, and I elevated my game so that not only that, when I get arrested and go to prison, I run with a bunch of crazy, you know, violent criminals, and I become an even bigger criminal.
So do you like a crew with you at this point in time? It's not just you alone robbing a bank?
It was me. Okay, that's a really interesting story. I was me mostly alone.
Okay.
Because when I get arrested, I get sent out on bail. And again, it's in Get the Money and Run tells a story of how when I get out on bail, I ran and robbed five more banks. But also some of the banks.
Once you pop, you can't stop, right?
The easiest thing in the world. Back then, now it's like, just, wow, now it's so challenging. Me and my friends, I was talking about it like, is you have to almost do a new hustle. Bank robbing doesn't seem like it would pay at all. And there's so many ways, how it's more challenges than it was back in the late 80s. Anyway, the truth is that I was not well and fast, living fast, and no sense of posterity. Like the only way you can live like that is you can't feel that I have a feel for the next day or next week or next couple months. You're not planning to live long.
Yeah.
As it is. An interesting thing. At age 26, I start robbing banks. And that was the year my mother died. She died at age 26. And it's almost as if I thought, I made it to 26. What comes after? I have no clue.
Yeah.
I can now risk my life all I want. I made it to 26. Yeah. I can die now. So I want to do. Let me put my life at risk and let me just go. And I went crazy. Mm-hmm. And so, technically I went bipolar and went wild. But, yeah, I ended up doing 7 years in federal penitentiary, about two of them in solitary for violent investigations I was a part of, And then I ended up changing my life in solitary. I had a hallucination, and another thing, the part of being bipolar, sometimes you hallucinate. I had this hallucination of a bald boy in my cell, and it scared me to death, because when guys go crazy in solitary, I had seen three men do it, and one of them walked out of his cell like he had used color pencils on his cheeks,
uh-huh.
and flipped his t-shirt inside out, rolled his boxers up into panties, and wanted to be called some woman's name. There's another guy who wiped his feces on himself. Yeah. And I'm thinking, I can't tell the difference between reality and fantasy. Now I'm hallucinating. Like, what's going to happen to me? I'm scared to death. But fortunately, like within a day, I realized that I knew a bald boy when I was a kid, when I was 7. He had leukemia. We were friends for like 3 months when he rode his bike into my neighborhood. And then he died. And so I wrote about that bald kid. And that's the first thing I wrote that ended up in my memoir, The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell, mm-hmm. Confessions of a Bank Robber. That's the first thing I wrote, was a story of me and that little bald kid. And so then, because I started writing about my childhood when I was innocent and my mother was still alive and she was still healthy at that time, I started thinking about all these great moments in my childhood, the innocent moments. Which now at this time, I'm as bad as I've ever been. You know, I'm stabbing people in prison. I'm under investigation, homicide of my ex-cellmate. I'm like running with guys that were all in trouble all the time. I've turned myself into this really violent person, and I had no feel for myself as innocent.
Yeah.
But then I start writing the stories from my childhood, and it's like a fissure crack in the cement, and all of a sudden, all these like little beautiful things started creeping up. And I had memories of me like, oh, man, that person. Oh, and that, all this beautiful stuff. And because I was broken by that hallucination, because I was humbled by it. I mean, I was really like, oh, I'm not as in control of things as I thought. Mm-hmm. I thought I had a strong mind. I thought I was a strong guy. And then my brain fissured like that. I was like, okay, I can't lie to myself. I can lie to all these men in the prison. I can still make them believe you don't want to mess with me. I could still promote a sort of like leave me alone, but now I got to do this internal work to figure out how to get myself out and stay out. But I need to still give myself cover, use the reputation I've developed. It was this most one of the most ironic things in my life. I needed to make men afraid of me still when I got out of solitary, so that I could go into my cell and do all this work to make me soft, so I could come out here and be a nice guy. My interior work was underwritten by promoting, like, don't mess with me. And my friend here I'm staying with today, mm-hmm. Who I was in prison with, he knew the guy who was doing the work, but also the nice guy, because we were good friends in prison. He knew I was trying to do the work to get out, but he also knew I was the guy on the prison tier trying, like, don't want to mess with me. But I ended up changing my life by doing all this writing, and I developed this correspondence with this famous essayist named Richard Rodriguez, who used to write for Harper's, and he had a column in the LA Times every Sunday. He's this great essayist and really smart guy. And I saw him on WGBH, Boston PBS station. He used to do videos for his old TV show called the McNeil Lehrer News Hour. Mm-hmm. And so he did video essays for them back in the day in the early 90s. And I saw him mid-90s. And I saw him, and I sent him a letter and say, hey, you know, you want to be pen pals? And we were for 2 years. And when he said, you know, when you get out, you need to write. Because I would be writing him things that I was now writing that were going to end up in my memoir, or just sharing my life stories and my insights into prison and that kind of stuff. I changed my life. I became a writer. And then when I got out in 96, he was like, dude, you're a writer. Let me get you some work. And immediately I started writing for like the first piece in 3 months. It was the San Francisco Examiner, then it was LA Weekly, then a big op-ed in the LA Times, you know, all within 7 months of being out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
And then 48 Hours came calling and said, hey, can you do a video essay for us on bank robbery? After this big bank robbery in North Hollywood, where these two guys went in, shot up everything, walked out, and the police, they were shooting at the cops. Big famous bank robbery in North Hollywood in 1997. I wrote about it and said, it's not a botched heist like everyone was reporting. I said it was a successful suicide. And that got me on TV, and I started becoming a talking head. Mm-hmm. I would be on CNN and all this kind of stuff, and I'm writing my memoir. and writing essays and exploring my life, and you know, really had changed my life. And I came out also and was like, Dad, check it out. You did a bunch of terrible things. I did a bunch of terrible things. Let's cross out yours. Let's cross out mine. Let's start fresh. Mm-hmm. Let's start over. I got love in my heart now. I'm trying to work through things. You're trying to work through things. I think we can figure this out. Let's get back to where we believe we're supposed to have. And so right now, my dad and I are tight. I talk to him every Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday night. My brother talks to him three other nights, and then my brother sees him every Tuesday. He helps him like do all his errands. He goes to his house and, you know, takes him lunch, movie, and drives him around because he can't see very well. But I was just – every time I'm in L.A. from the Bay Area, we go to dinner. Me and my girlfriend just there recently.
Yeah.
We have a loving – we're a loving home. My dad, our story, our narrative of a care and repair to build a loving relationship is a powerful one, because even my daughter, who's 19 now, she mentioned the other day, she said, you know, she feels like one of the good things about being raised in her family is that she learned early that you can repair any relationship if two people are willing. Mm-hmm. Because our family legacy now to her, you know, I have all these bank robberies and I changed my life around. But the most important thing to me is the love story between me and my father, and my, you know, mm-hmm. and how that when I stabbed and tried to kill him, that devastated our home. That we didn't have a home. It was like, you know, we didn't have no power. It just was gone. I obliterated that. Right. Oh, you know what? That's my phone telling me I'm supposed to call my dad.
see, he felt
the irony. Yeah.
At 5 o'clock, I get notified to call my dad on my days.
Yeah.
Anyway, but here's the point I want to make is that I want to tell you this quick story about me and my dad to kind of tell you where we are now. When we go into we've gone into prisons to talk to men who have beat up their children, their wives, or girlfriends, and these guys get this this program where instead of going to prison, they get this modified program where they have to go learn to deal with their anger and their emotions and their insecurities and all that stuff. And then people like me go in there and explain what it's like to be a victim to them and like being beat by my father and stuff. But then I flip it and tell them how I became like them. Mm-hmm. I became violent and I hurt other people because I didn't know how to manage my rage. And I talked to them from both sides. Like, here's what it's like to be a victim. And here's what it's like for you guys. And you guys are wrong, and here's how you can change it. Well, I brought my dad in several times, and they love to listen to my dad because he confronts them. He says, mm-hmm. You guys think it was them. You think it was your wife if she hadn't said this, your kids if they hadn't done that. But you know, like I knew in the bottom of my heart in the dark of the night that it was on me. I didn't know how to handle myself. It's my fault. And my dad's real honest about that, but he tells a story. Because it's really powerful for them to see me tell my story being almost killing my dad. And then my dad comes up right there and they're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
What? It's hard for him to reconcile that. And he tells a story and the guys are just, it's amazing. Guys with tattoos on their face. They look all like dang. And they're just like riveted by our story and they're quiet. And it's very intense. My dad's explaining how I'm coming to stab him. We're wrestling and fighting for the knife. And then he says, you know, when Joe stabbed me and that knife went in my neck, he said, I instantly knew it was my fault. The Bible says, don't exasperate your children. And I exasperated my son who loved me when he was a baby. He says, but when Joe started twisting it off to try and break it on my neck, I was like, oh, that's just Joe being an asshole. And everyone starts laughing. Everyone starts laughing. I'm laughing because I'm ready to turn to a puddle up there. It's so emotional. Yeah. So powerful and stuff like that. But my daddy has this dark sense of humor because we survived this thing.
Yeah.
And everyone laughs, you know, the guards and everyone, they're kind of allowed to be relieved of the moment. But it's this really dark moment. My dad has a good sense of humor about it. And when we all get together, me, my brother, and my dad, we're very loving. We're very playful. Anyone who's around us says, like, you know, they've never seen anything like it. And they probably haven't because we're willing to do the work. And I have a father who, from the minute that he could, he would show contrition. He knew how to be humble. And mm-hmm. he's taught me a lot about, and when I make mistakes since I've come out of prison, I know how to be humble. I know how to say I'm sorry. I know how to work and try to repair things. And it doesn't come easy. We had to do a lot of work to get to where we are. None of this is easy. That's precisely why most people don't get to this.
Yeah.
They don't get to repair things because they go halfway. They don't know exactly how to meet the day. They don't know how to get the best of themselves to rise up to the occasion to try to address the thing. We're so muddied. We're so unfocused. We're so not questioning ourselves and not asking the right questions about ourselves. And so it's challenging, but I'm fortunate. I feel blessed. I have a 19-year-old daughter. We've had our own challenges, but like I said, you know, the great thing is she has seen me already work on the relationship with my father. And she knows that, hey, well, that means we get to work on ours. And we do. We talk things seriously and work through things. And, you know, it was a rough life to get here. Mm-hmm. But like me and my friend who I'm staying with, he has his daughters too there. And like I said, just graduated college. We were in prison together.
Yeah.
And we knew what it was like to be desperate and alone and angry. And then we came out and we found love and we found family. And we're now men over here drinking down this by a stream on a summer night in Connecticut. And it's like, it's beautiful. My girl is sitting here with us, watching us, and it's lovely. We finally made lives of ourselves that are not these brutish, angry, scary moments, desperate times. It's about trying to put goodness in the world. And he and I are drinking our beers and laughing in the morning and at night. We're just enjoying being men who figured it out.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I think more young men need to hear your message.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a whole life ahead of you, and you may not remotely see it at that moment in that time, but the sooner one can realize there is a good life ahead, should you want to make those decisions, but it is up to you. It's not based on the trauma and the shit you went through. You don't have to keep making bad choices because of what someone else bad did to you, but that's a hard one to make, but you obviously have come out the other side. Joe, what you're doing is amazing and wonderful, and I completely commend you. I think that's amazing, and I can only imagine the amount of lives that you are changing, and the stories that your daughter will continue to get long after you're gone from people who've said, you know, your dad really made an influence on me. And that's
excited about thing. That. But you know, I'm happy just that she's talking to me and we're loving each other. We're going to get our own podcast now. So
yeah,
we're excited. I'm excited about that. Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's fabulous. Thank you for sharing your story with us. We really appreciate it.
I do. And everyone go out to listen, get the money and run. There's 7 episodes of it of me telling great stories and unpacking them.
Yeah.
It's pretty fun.
Joe Loya, check it out. It is from Orbit Media, The Burden, Get the Money and Run. Go check it out. Joe, thank you so much for talking with us today. I want Liberty to know. Let me know what you guys think about Joe's story in the comment section on our YouTube page. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi if you're not already there. If you're listening to us on the podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever it may be, please do check out YouTube. It's a great place where you can comment on all of the stories that we cover for you. Again, Joe Loya, Get the Money and Run. Search for it wherever you get podcasts.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to care for yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps. Ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com today for 10% off your first month.